I hope you're not freaked out anyway. The title of the talk is something I just put together, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, really just to get your attention. So it's not really. But there's like five presentations that could probably go on for 4 hours, but we have 55 minutes on the tape. So I'll start out with forensic entomology. And entomophagy, the use of insects as food, they sort of go hand in hand sometimes. Spiders and bed bugs, or bed bugs and spiders. I met Greg, actually, because of the bed bug work I do. And then he and another few researchers will be working on medical aspects of bed bugs and the molecular aspects, too. So the first section, it's not just dead bodies. Because most people, because of the CSI shows, movies and things like that, you always see forensics and corpses. But I'll explain a little bit more about that. Oh, I'm happy I'm at a desk working on a microscope. Most of the work I do is actually on spiders, spider taxonomy and systematics. In forensic entomology, and I'll read through this, utility of arthropods in legal investigations, the field where arthropod science and judicial system interact, and certain forensic entomology investigations are utilized by law enforcement agencies, and that's mostly homicide investigation. And here is a court. There's an associate of mine who's actually explaining about the life cycle of a fly, because that's what the jurors have to understand in order to grasp what's going on with the corpse and the insects or mites that have been found on it. But there are actually three different types of forensic entomology. There's urban entomology, which encompasses the insects in buildings and homes and structures and things like that. Stored products entomology is obviously food-related infestations. Medical criminal entomology, or medical legal entomology, is the part about homicide investigations and the estimation of the post-mortem interval or time of death. And I'll explain a little bit more about that post-mortem interval. But the entomological evidence will, like I said, assist in the PMI. The geographic location of death, sites of trauma on the remains, and toxicological levels from the larvae, because the larvae are what they eat. And if they're feeding on a person who did a lot of drugs, they have the drugs inside them now, and you can test them. Geographic location. In some cases, there are times when insects are found on a corpse, but those insects aren't known to occur where that corpse was found, but they occur in some other area. So it's very possible the body had been transported sometime after death to this new location. And sites of trauma, sometimes you'll find infestations on the body, because when you investigate and clean out an area of the body, you see is a wound, and that was attractive to certain insects that are there. It could be mostly flies are the ones we're interested in. Also beetles are very common types of creatures that are attracted. A postmortem interval, though, you can divide into time after death and also insect colonization, because there's times when, even though there's a time after death, insects couldn't get to that corpse. So that means the time involved would not fare directly from time after death, but it's when the insects could get there, and that would throw off your postmortem interval. This is a diagram just of how insects in different decay processes on the body would occur from death through a fresh bloat, active decay. You have biomass loss, you have advanced decay, putrid dry remains, and in all those different cases, you would have different creatures attracted, either because they feed on the corpse or they feed on the insects that are feeding on the corpse. Oh yeah, we're doing this after lunch, sorry. Here's our remains from one of my associate's studies. This was actually done in Knoxville at the Body Farm, where they're place it there where originally it was an anthropological study in taphonomy, but then people who work there also realize it's good to. So they have corpses either in the water, on land, buried, not buried, in trees, partly clothed, not clothed. And these are people who have willed their bodies, or I believe they're also there because they're not claimed. They're unclaimed. And you see the time involved, although you can't really tell too well. Maybe this is 15th of July, which happens to be today, many, many years ago in 1989. And 20th, you'll notice high, you have a dried remains of the corpse. You have, this is where the maggot mass is leaving. This is the 23rd of July. And if everything goes well, you'll have masses of the maggots leaving at one time because they were all, more or less, the eggs were laid at that time. Or in the case of sarcophagid flies, a larvae were dropped because there the female doesn't produce eggs and lay eggs. She develops the larvae inside her and deposits the first instar larvae on the corpse. So they have a 24-hour jump ahead of other insects that are there. But as the remains are gone, you can have thousands of fly larvae or maggots in mass leaving the corpse and leaving a slime trail and going down in leaf litter in order to pupate now. This is the 25th of the month, and you see how skeletonized it is. A dry remains. Here would be many beetles can be attracted at this point, the 9th of August. And here are some studies. This particular one just is explaining about the different waves where insects were attracted and the state of the corpse at that particular time, and then what particular insects were attracted over that period of time, and also the age of the corpse. So you'll notice a lot of flies, either calophords or mussids, sarcophagids, are attracted very early in time. You have other flies. These pyophilids are usually there when the corpse is dry. They're called cheese skippers. The larvae are able to grab their rear ends, release it, and it makes them skip or pop. That's how they get out of certain areas when they're maybe you want to leave a corpse. Or the common name is cheese skipper, so they'll also infest cheeses, too. And here is a bar-type graph where the relative numbers of insects, as you can see, is where the relative thickness of the bar is. So you have blowfly larvae early on, like what it showed in the previous diagram, previous listing. And that sort of ends about a time when things start drying out. And certain flies here will be predaceous on other flies that are there. Various insects like staphylinid beetles will be attracted and also feed on the larvae that are there. We have mites that might be doing that too. Parasitic wasps are parasitic on the insects that are there. And they're only going to be attracted by the time the larvae are at the right stage of development and the female wasp will be attracted to lay eggs in there. So it's all very much intertwined in what's going on. Here, the generalized life stage of a fly, where you have the eggs laid, it takes about 23 hours. At here, at 70 degrees. You get the first instar larvae. You get 27 more hours at that same temperature, second and third. And you get a pre-pupal form, and you get the pupa, which is actually called a puparium because its third instar's larval skin actually hardens and the pupa develops inside that. This is the generalized timeline for that to occur. And pigs are used often to simulate human bodies. So a lot of the studies are performed, and this is an old one you see because it's an old thermometer instead of a digital type thermometer that would have been left here. And then with the new digital thermometers, you wouldn't even, and you can even set a camera up here, you wouldn't have to go and check every day. You would just get the information sent to you. And also movies of what's going on. You see if any foxes or other animals came in and were chewing up your test study here, test body and corpse. You see it bloated on the 16th. A friend of mine runs these out of his farm in Indiana often. He has classes out there too. You can see here the 18th, these are thousands of maggots that have completed development. And this would be a normal study because everything is going just right. But if you had a human corpse that was clothed, it might not work this way. Or it was bagged up or cut up and placed in plastic bags, it wouldn't work this way. So all those things would contribute to the for you to figure out the postmortem interval based on the data you get. Here's the 19th. You'll notice there's a few maggots left, but basically they've already left. That means when you go to a crime scene, you can't just collect stuff right on the corpse. You have to go about 30 feet around it because you may have had larvae moving away. That would have been the first wave of larvae leaving. And you could base this now on what you have here. You'd be off maybe a week in that case. These are various creatures that are found on or can be found on human corpses. A spider would be from the vicinity, not normally on a person, let's say. The earwigs, Columbella. This would be an amphipod. That would be aquatic. You have different mites that could be in the soil. Often when they're... When the corpse is there, your whole mite fauna changes because the ones that are there already may not do well with liquefied remains in their backyard. So they leave, and maybe others would be coming in to take their place. You have fleas, crab lice, body or head lice. If you were to collect these, and also bed bugs, if you collect them from a site, you may get them on, because when the person dies, a lot of these parasites would leave. The bed bugs would normally be off the host and crawl on to get food and then go off again. So in some of the home situations, if you were to collect bed bugs, you could assay the blood that's inside them. You may come up with different perps who are not in your list because the bugs have been there. They've been feeding on the people. So they now have a reservoir of test blood for you to look at. You can have various insects that are not normally parasitic, but could be, if it's outdoor situation, associated with a corpse. There's even little booklets that now, for the layman, to explain, you know, what types of creatures you may find. And you'll notice these are different species of flies. And it's almost impossible to identify the different species based on these little pictures. But it's just to give you an idea of what can be found. You have sylphid beetles. You have this black soldier fly where you'll have larvae that are attracted to the corpse. You know, there's so many different things that can be there, and they're all important, so everything should be collected. You can identify them later or send it out to a specialist to identify. This type of staphylinid is actually predaceous, so that's feeding on the larvae of flies that are on the corpse. And if you have even ants that are there, they're feeding on the larvae of the corpse. And in some cases, they may remove almost all the larvae that are there and feed them to their own larvae, chew them up and feed them. So that's going to actually slow down the destruction of that corpse because there's nothing there to feed on them anymore. So all that has to be taken into account when you're studying the forensics of it. There's certain beetles that are attracted to fungus. So you may have those attracted later on because of what's actually on that corpse, what's growing on the corpse after it breaks down to a certain point. All different types of flies. Fly pupa, this is a forage fly. They're usually attracted to dry remains, and they've been known to burrow down a few feet to find the corpse. And they're quite small. They find them in your sinks, sometimes in your homes. The larvae feed on organic ooze that's around the sink and on your drains, and sometimes in rotting fruit and maybe food that you might have around. They're a characteristic little hopping, jumping kind of flies more than just those that just fly around. These are Drosophila flies here. And there are many species. People think of this as a fruit fly when, in fact, it's a pumice fly or a vinegar fly, and they're really attracted to byproducts in alcohol. So that's why you actually have them attracted to fruits. It's because it's fermenting, not that they like the fruit that much. Now here, you have a fly leaving the puparium, and you notice the front of its head is soft because it had to pop the cover off of this puparium in order to get out. So that would, if you were to get flies at this point in your site, you would know that's very recently emerged from the puparium because of its less sclerotized body. This is a mouth hook on a larva, which would be over in here. This is a stigmatal plate, which should be at the back end. That's how it breathes. This is a common bluebottle fly showing the egg, larval stages. This is a puparium, and if you open it up, you see there's a pupa inside there. And by looking at the puparia, you also realize that a light-colored one is one that just became a puparium. This one has been hours later, or days later, and now it's dark and sclerotized. So all these things you find, if you don't raise them, you might not know what insect species you have, because most of the taxonomy is based on the adults. It's easier to identify adults than it is larval flies in many cases. But now there's some molecular work, and it's possible in some cases to simply test the maggot you have, and it should match up with known identifications of flies too. And this just simply shows over a certain temperature the development of the pupa or the puparium. You notice how it starts out pale and gets darker. So if people were investigating a case and came up with pale-colored ones as opposed to dark-colored ones and went into the research and saw the papers that reported this, you get a better idea of what time period this is. This is showing the first instar maggots. I raised a few on liver, so you see here different life stages of a younger third instar maggot, some puparia, pale-colored puparia. So you see the generalized biology going on here as it's reflected in the coloration of these creatures. You'll notice that, here, when it's feeding, the rear end of the fly has the basic or the larger breathing area. So it's able to feed at the front but breathe at the rear end. So that's why you'll see in some wounds, you'll see a maggot sticking out. You'll see two little eyes, which are not eyes. They're actually stigmatal plates for breathing. Here's one sort of popped out here. This is a beef liver I'm using. And raising them in here, this is vermiculite, where the larvae would leave when it was time to pupate. And here. This is just explaining about certain larval flies and what structures have to be looked at in order to identify them. And if you look at this particular maggot, you notice it's a hairy maggot. And when it's in a wet, soupy mixture that it's living in, that helps keep it afloat. So it actually doesn't go into the bottom. It actually can stay on the surface. And by movement, you know, get around that way, not drown. And certain fly maggots, when they're normally feeding on a corpse, sometimes what happens is by having them highly populated in one area, they start turning into cannibalistic tendencies and will start feeding on other maggots that are there when normally they wouldn't do that. But then again, there are also some that are facultative, some that are obligatory, and they actually do only feed on other maggots that are there. These are just some of the structures that have to be examined in forensic cases, like we went over already. And some of the various stigmatal plates of different fly species. So you see some are very distinctive. The third larval stage has three of these breathing plates. The second has two, the first has one. And here is where you see from the second is in that small little open section in the center. That's the second instars, and this is the third. So that's still retained when this insect has molted, and it goes from the second to third. And here's some adults that I was keeping. You'll notice here is one that's about a day old. This one's much less. You see how pale it is. It just recently closed from the puparium, and you see the front part of its head is expanded out. That's the tilinum, which pops the cover off the puparium. That's how it gets out when it's ready to leave. And these are different structures to look at when that's going on for identification of flies. There are wing venation, there's cells. And here is a whole roadmap of setae on the fly, where all these hairs, or actually setae, are in specific places. It's not just all flies have a helter-skelter, you know, distribution of hairs. They're very specific places that have hairs that are going in certain directions, are divergent or convergent, or maybe in certain species, a certain one is actually missing, and all the ones that are related to it, that little structure is there. Showing some of the bristles, setae on the thorax, how the abdomen is constructed, head. And here, there are some cases where this is a fire ant feeding on skin, but some people had misidentified as chemical burns, not realizing that the insects did that. Here's a chromatogaster ant was actually taking a fly maggot away. Now, we're out of the homicide end of it, and this is into either the, well, this is actually the urban entomology part. The book was in a garbage can, but the mass of material that these dermestid beetles were feeding on was next door in the can. And they fed on this organic stuff, left, and they bored in to the book in order to pupate. So this was a dermestes larva. And you could see that this is a plump little larva. It's now, this is a pupa here. So this took a certain amount of time for this to occur. And hundreds of years ago, when people were transporting dried skins, animal skins, on wooden ships, the animal skins had dermestid larvae. And they would leave that skin and bore into the wood hull. And if they bored too far, they created holes. And if you had a lot of them there, you had some problem with water intake on those ships. Some of the studies I've been working on this is with dermestid beetles too, in the urban setting, is working with pest control people. And this is skeletonized mice from dermestid beetles that were in a trap. This is a multiple catch trap that obviously hadn't been cleaned out enough. A fur Eskimo boot here. There was some damage. And this, you can see, there's this a moth. It's a tineid moth that was grazing on the hair. And you can see the droppings that the moth caterpillar left when it was feeding. And sometimes the caterpillars would be a different color depending what food item they're feeding on. So feeding on this red felt, the moth would have a lot of redness in its body. Some of the stored food products that have caterpillars feed on pistachios are actually more greenish. Here's a close-up of some of that damage. It just sort of grazed right off, took all that fur right off. It's very characteristic. And as it crawls, it's shedding its skin too. So you'll have a mixture of head capsules of caterpillars plus their shed skin bodies that are there, just like a glove. And a book, when the pest control companies were seeing the droppings here and were treating by putting rodenticides out. But actually, this is American cockroach droppings, which here's one American cockroach feeding on some material. It was one of the researchers at the museum. She would go out every night with a flashlight and red lights and watch all the roaches living throughout all of the different levels in the museum. And she'd number some of them, and you'd catch them in different places, so you knew they were migrating around. The males would be out at their territories, and if you watch them at night, they would start jabbing other males in order to keep them away from their territories. And if they get punctured too much, the bacteria gets inside them, and they'll succumb to that infection, too. This was an infestation. The first pest control company saw this sawdust and said, well, we have to treat your closet because of the wood damage that's occurring there. But it was something was a little fishy, because it smelled a little fishy. And what it was with a piranha from Venezuela on the shelf, there were five different species of beetles living inside this piranha, the dried, you know, fish, and feeding on it. and all of this powder was coming out off the shelf and dropping onto the floor. The holes that were in the shelves were actually screw holes, and there was a screw head all the way inside there. It wasn't any insect damage at all. So getting rid of this dried fish got rid of the problem. And if you go to bars and you have little containers of nuts to eat, it's really the best thing for you to do is look before you grab, because a lot of nuts will support a lot of insect species. And this is, you know, inside the nut, you have these beetles living, and they've been living here through most of their lives. So all larval stages going on in here, defecating, leaving the droppings in there.
Yummy.
And here, too, different species of beetles in the nuts, walnuts, cashews. And you can see all the light droppings because cashews are light. So the caterpillar's head is here, the body's here. There's a pupa here. There's a dried caterpillar here because this had been fumigated, but not well enough. So there was still some live caterpillars still feeding on material in there. And pistachios with Indian meal moths. Well, actually, it's different, Hephaestia, not Indian meal moth. And this is one caterpillar inside each pistachio. Sometimes if there's more than one, the caterpillars actually feed on each other, even though they're really not animal feeding creatures, they're, you know, vegetable feeding creatures. And here is a material from France. It was a food item where these Plodia caterpillars were feeding on the material coming through the cellophane and then pupating inside the corrugated cardboard. Or even this risotto, if you notice, all the beetles were leaving, they were making nice little holes and leaving. So if you, whatever you eat, you should look at before pouring it to cook it, or eat it for that matter. And this was a trochoderma, dermestid larvae, inside a oatmeal. You can see that underneath the oatmeal they had bored out, and they were living between the bottom of the oatmeal container and the flooring. And these have caused gastritis in children, I know, when there were some reports of that. They have specialized hastaceti, which are spear-shaped, spear-headed ceti. They will, you know, bother either the skin and cause dermatitis and sometimes misidentified as bed bug bites now, or an internal problem. Breadcrumbs, you'll notice this has to be a caterpillar because of all the silk that's left. That's what caterpillars produce, a lot of silk as they crawl around. And this is an apricot with many of the Carpoglyphus lactis mites living on it. Or a house had termite damage. This is into urban entomology here. And even the books on the floor were infested with termites. Here are the workers. And Latrodiid beetles, these are tiny little beetles that are called black or brown, minute brown scavenger beetles, plaster beetles, and many of these species, in fact, all of them feed on fungus and mold, and you'll find them in many apartments, and that really signifies there's a water problem somewhere and a mold problem someplace. They're about a few millimeters long. And this is a vault where I was looking at the insects that were there that at first were misidentified as little gnats, and they were told to get rid of all the potted plants because the flies were living. But these are actually micromouthed beetles. It's the way the vault was constructed out of minerals, and it was a red oak plywood. And the plywood was never kiln dried. It was just put in there. And it was at the right rotting stage that attracted these very, very interesting beetles that normally you don't see them at all. We collected thousands from these locations. And they were living inside the walls of the vault, and after about 5 years after installation, there was mold and fungus and mushrooms growing. There were pseudoscorpions and beetles, and these interesting beetles emerging and flying all around. The walls were opened up, holes were cut into it, water was drained out because there was a lot of water inside there. And the insects themselves, are these little insects here. They're a few millimeters long. They have an interesting life cycle, though, where the adults can produce the next generation. The larvae can either stay and look larviform and become a female, or they can usually, let's see, emerge as larvae and then feed on the mother that gave birth to them. So they have a very strange, different life cycle from normal beetles that you normally come across. And these are also males and females are a little different. The males have little structures under the abdomen that produce probably a pheromone to attract the females. And what I do a lot now, instead of going out in the field, a lot of material is usually captured on glue boards and brought over to look at to see what's going on in a situation. So those were beetles. These are roaches. Oh, let me switch to the second part of a forensic one. Trying to cover too much in one place. With the insect fly maggots, since I worked in entomophagy, the use of insects as food, I thought it might be kind of interesting in cases where you capture fly maggots from corpses, and if you don't have hot water with you to fix the tissue and then put it in alcohol or use a larval preservative, why not try citrus juices and create a type of ceviche with these white-colored maggots? Well, actually, I was on a Discovery Channel. We did try these, too, after I made them. And they were citrus-flavored. They're pretty good. You have to let them go for a while, though, not just 20 hours or 24 hours or a few hours, like some of the normal menu, some of the normal recipes would have you do it. But this was with a high school students who wanted to do some work, and I came up with this, and then I presented it at one of the forensic meetings in the North American Forensic Entomology Association meeting. Well, as I explained already, if you don't have the right things, why not try citrus juices? And if you know about the proteins, you're using various methods to denature it in order to, it looks like it's being cooked, of course, when you use a ceviche method. So by making a marinade of citrus, various citrus juices, we tried sarcophagin maggots. These are the large black and gray checkerboard kind of flies that produce larvae as opposed to producing eggs. And from a supply house, I got the third instar maggots right before they're going to pupate. And they have a very thick skin, and take it from me, they're a little chewy when you do it. But they tasted all right. They were well cooked. Anyway, this is a little different history of ceviche. And in 1992, I ran a banquet. We had the use of insects as food. So we tried different insects as part of the meal. I interviewed about a few different catering companies in the city. And of course, some didn't want to bother with it, but some did. And they were very good and we're really interested in coming up with various dishes and using more of the common insects. We use crickets because they're easy to get and they're good animal food. We had mealworms, and we had waxworms, which is a mealworm's a beetle larva, and a waxworm is a caterpillar of a wax moth, which is, and these are all raised for animal food. I found out because for many years I raised mealworms for animal food, for pet, you know, creatures I kept. I had an inhalant allergy to mealworms, and I also had a digestive allergy to mealworms. So that became one of the scientific papers that I did. It was with an allergist, an immunologist, and he also had patients who worked in bakeries where they would have various reactions to the flour, when in fact they're probably having reactions to insects that were in the flour. But I had a very strange digestive reaction to mealworms after trying them. And then that whole thing, about 24 hours later, the symptoms came back again. So I don't eat mealworms. But anything else is pretty good. And I also recreated one for Japanese TV. They wanted to do the whole thing again, which was too expensive. But we did a few different insects. The mealworms, waxworms. We had large, giant mealworms. They're about an inch and a half long, although I didn't eat those. We had the Thai water bugs, which are not water bugs as cockroaches, but they're actually a hemipteran. It's actually a true bug. It's called an electric light bug. And I might have pictures, I think, of those. Yeah, the electric light bugs are these here, this one in the center. And we didn't have this grasshopper. This is for a show. And these are big Kurrajong grubs. These are beetle larvae from Australia. It's not a witchetty grub, which actually is a caterpillar from Australia, but we didn't have those. And the when you cook these, you actually eat the muscle that's in the thorax, because that's basically the largest muscle system they have, because it works their wings. And they have, as in bed bugs and other true bugs, they have various gland secretions that smell a little like coriander or cilantro or citronella, and in different amounts, in different smells like that. And in Thailand, where these are actually cooked in brine and put in blister packs, and you can get them in Chinatown here, which is what we did.
Where do you get them?
Chinatown?
Huh?
Yeah, in Thai stores usually. Yeah. These, they're a little salty from brine, so you have to sort of parboil them or just at least keep them in water to get that excess salt out. And we even tried hissing roaches another time, where we roasted those, and that you just eat the muscle that's in the thorax too. It doesn't smell like an American roach. It's really not a musty smell. It's actually not a bad smell for hissing roaches. And you've seen the hissing roaches, you know, on different TV shows. You've seen amblypygid, arachnids on different TV shows, just for effect. But some of those are tasty. And in fact, these are palm weevils, which we didn't have, but you see how large that larva is. It'd be a nice little sausage. This one in a hot dog roll would fit pretty well, actually, here. And there's even an ant wine made in China. And the tarantula from Venezuela, I cooked for Japanese TV. This was cooked for the Explorers Club tempura style, except this particular spider is a New World tarantula. New World tarantulas have urticating hairs, so you have to make sure you get rid of those hairs before you eat it. And these were not done that way. So people had problems in eating the urticating hairs and tempura batter that were the fine little hairs that would be here, not these heavy, seedy. But there's some of the hairs, you know, microscopically have these little structures, and they're characteristically on a pedestal, like a leaf is on a tree branch. So it actually is made to break off. And normally what happens, the tarantulas will kick and produce a cloud of this stuff to ward off predators, people included. Anyway, for the citrus material, we use various juices, either from fresh fruits or concentrated. Concentrated works better. These are two students who worked. They didn't mind, you know, playing around with the maggots at all. And you see, we had also housefly maggots, too. And we made different solutions up, put the maggots in. And you'll see, some worked pretty well. It didn't work. Some didn't work well because it really wasn't long enough, we found out. So we had to go for about a week keeping the larvae inside there. And it worked pretty well, actually, in certain fruits. And then after a time, those could be used, and when you get back to the lab, you'd be able to do either put them in the right solution, put them in hot water, or the work could still be done on them because the maggots are actually in pretty good shape. Hot water is one of the better ways, though. So we'll just skip through. And of course, if you're, you know, sarcophagus splash probably isn't something Smirnoff wants to market, though. But when you look at the caterpillar inside the mezcal, if it's a well-preserved caterpillar, it looks good. If it's blackened, that means it didn't preserve well, so it's probably not enough alcohol content in that bottle. All right, now, let me try a third one. I think you probably have too much today on everything insect. But some people send me, you know, if they don't know what something is, I'll take it, put it on a scanner, if they can't take a picture, and scan it in. This happens to be a bed bug adult. It happens to be a male. You see the rear end of it. There's a, now when people, I've been raising bed bugs actually for about 15 or 20 years, and I realized I got them from a friend of mine who raised them, and he'd gotten them in 1973 from Fort Dix, New Jersey, and he kept that population going. And then if you wanted to work on some, he'd just send you a jar of them. And the easiest way to feed them, because there was a fine screen on top, you simply invert it on your arm and feed them. So that's what I've been doing. I am lucky I don't react badly to bed bug bites, so I can actually do it. Anyway, this is the common bed bug. This is the tropical bed bug. This is a different pronotal shape. Mostly you would be seeing this kind of creature. And there's bat bugs, because sometimes people will send in bugs, and actually they have a bat problem. So to get rid of the bugs, they have to get rid of the bats in their attic. There's swallow bugs. These are bird bugs. And they're actually different looking from the other bugs, from the true, you know, common bed bug. Life cycle of bed bugs. You have eggs laid by the female. You have a first instar hatching about 10 to 14 days. You'll have the different nymphs have to feed at least once to get enough blood inside them in order to progress to the next stage of development. So on perfect conditions, very hot temperatures in the 80s, and you have them feeding whenever they want to feed, it could take them maybe 4 weeks to go from egg to adult stage. These are just different life cycles that different people have provided. And some are really good because many cases people still can't identify bed bugs when they find them or find other things and not understand what is a bed bug, what isn't a bed bug. Here, though, they're calling them larvae when we don't really consider them larvae. And you have different, you know, these are fed, but what does this first instar larva look like when it's not fed, which would be like this. And this one was actually taken from previous ones in drawing form, but unfortunately created all the bugs to be the same, where they never looked this way. So anyone trying to identify bed bugs, and I brought some with me in a container with a magnifying glass if you want to look at them. This is a jar full of bed bugs. I took the cover off, and you can see a mixture of bugs. Actually, what no one really mentions, I have other pictures of it, the white droppings is a metabolic byproducts of nitrogenous waste in bed bugs. And most people are always looking for the dark droppings, which would be the digested blood. And this is just showing you some bed bugs, different colorations they have, top and bottom views. This is like cornflakes. This is a jar full of bed bugs. These are all shed skins and some adult bugs intermixed with it. Shed skin of the fifth instar bed bug and a bed bug just in a jar. And you see they're just doing different things. In fact, a lot of when I feed them, I always wondered what was going on. So after I fed them, I unscrewed the cover, and these bugs stayed here still trying to feed in that same place, all in one big mass. So there's like, you know, hundreds feeding at one time on me, or more, over like a 15-minute period of time. And you can see the white droppings, dark droppings, the eggs. The eggs, when they're first produced, have a cover plate, and they're also sticky, so they adhere to any place where the female leaves them. And then when the nymph comes out, it pops a cover off, which is what is going on over here. You look at this one just emerged, you see the cover's already off, you see a female laying an egg here, and you see a close-up of the glue on the egg. And that's why wherever that female places it, they're left there. So they may go in out-of-the-way places, and you'll finally have a little infestation because those bugs have been laid in a place where it's just out of your vision. And you won't notice it until maybe a week or so later when the bug is now hatched and now it's looking for a meal, which is you. You're the closest thing. You can see the red eye of the bug, so it's getting ready to hatch pretty soon. The cover plate's still here. And I kept bugs in different jars, and I just, in the little boxes, I wanted to see what they did. So no one really can explain why, instead of staying together, why do these bugs stay apart from one another? You see the droppings here? This is just overnight. And here you see quarter-inch squares. That's the nymph after it's hatched, and this is the nymph after it's fed. And this is a quarter-inch square right here. A female, she produced that nitrogenous waste. She produced an egg. And you'll notice a male and female here. This is over about a week's time, just seeing what eggs she produces, how many she produces. She more or less stayed in one place, and the male that was there just kept cavorting around. He probably would have mated with others if there were more there. You see, at this time, there's some droppings, too, from blood. That's defecated blood. And here, you see nymphs hatched. This one's about an hour older than this one. It's already a little darker color. This is an adult bed bug with a fifth instar skin still stuck on it. This one's more recently molted, molted the skin off. You see how pale it is. So people, in identifying bed bugs, would also not think this is a bed bug because they're told they're reddish brown in color. But that's only the adult bed bug. Here's an alert bed bug, not an alert bed bug. Mating, they have traumatic insemination, where the male has an asymmetrical genital structure, and there's an opposite area on the female, and he actually inserts through her body wall this structure, and sperm is released into the body wall in the body cavity. But it's evolved that way on purpose, so it's really not rape or anything, which people seem to equate with bed bugs. It's not psychological. This is just physical trauma. And they evolved this way, and it really works well in that species. It's fine. Even related species to bed bugs also still have that traumatic insemination, too. And you can see the Aediagus of the paramere and the Aediagus. This is of the male bed bug here. And a feeding bed bug. You can see how it keeps its mouth part bent backward. Here just showing how they'll change from a flat to a plump little bed bug. And even defecating, if they fed so much, they have no more room, they get rid of what was there before to give them space. They usually don't defecate on the person, though. It's normally they'll feed, go away, and then defecate, which is one of the reasons they're not really transmitting disease through the fecal route like related triatome retivid bugs, because they'll do that. They feed, they defecate, that transmits trypanosomiasis, and the person scratches the wound where that is occurring, and that's how that gets into the skin. And here I have a mating couple on me feeding. This is a birthmark, a red mark on my left hand. And you could see a bed bug's feeding. Now watch this first instar nymph here. Just a few minutes after, you notice how red it becomes. It's easier to see. And here, there's actually a mixture of body lice and bugs. So you can tell which is which by the letters I placed on them, for pediculus versus simex. These are not from off the street. These are from a lab that raised these insects for studies they do at UMass. And showing a first instar bed bug feeding on my finger. And you notice how it takes a few minutes until it gets plump, and watch different views of a millimeter long bug filling up. And these are various bite reactions people have gotten from bed bugs. And people think, well, it's in a line, it must be a bed bug. But actually what happens, it may be the clothing or the bedding that's near here, because bed bugs are kind of lazy. They don't have to crawl on you in order to feed. They'll stay near you, stick the proboscis out, and feed. So like these are feeding on me, but they're actually not on me. They're holding onto the cardboard in the jar. They just didn't crawl out further. Or these here, same idea. So that's forming a straight line because they're on a line of cardboard. People react differently to different, you know, bed bug bites, which is why it's very difficult to identify if it's a bed bug because of the bite reaction you're getting. And this is on my hand, and about an hour later, it's all gone. And these are just the areas where the bite occurred. Is under the skin, there's a little hemorrhaging that goes on. And this is how some of the bites are on my hand. So people wouldn't notice that this is a bed bug bite from those reactions here. And this is the close-up of it.
Don't they hurt?
They don't bother me at all. No. These were on a friend. She had these marks on her leg. But on her arm, she had almost no reaction. It may have been that this was a day later, you know, earlier she was bitten, it's possible. This person feeds bed bugs for dogs, so the container is a circular opening. That's the reason why these are circular marks on the skin. And here too. And this one's on my arm, shows a reaction, the initial reaction to the bites, and then a swelling after, but that's hundreds feeding in one place. Oh. Which it goes away in a few days, it doesn't bother me, and it's gone. Other people can react very badly, though, to the bites.
How long do they feed on you?
I feed them only 15 minutes. So when bugs are finished, they leave. Others are pushing, getting into their place.
Every day?
No, every maybe a week, 2 weeks. If you want to keep a pet, it's easy. You don't have to remember to feed them. And if you forget for a month, 2 months, 3 months, they're probably still around. And this is when the jar was open. You see how are there. Although I did do this for Discovery Channel, I let them stay about 20 minutes, and I noticed what happened is the surface skin was peeling off from feeding so much in one place. But then it was fine. This became a little water blister type reaction in here from feeding and moving the container too much. And some people also experience this. And that disappeared. That was all right, too. It scabbed over. Some people have very bad reactions. Some researchers, Harold Harlan, whose bugs he got in 1970s, and here an associate of his, he reacts very differently to bites. This is the big jar, though, feeding of bugs. It's not just one bite here. And that same jar in this person, he reacted that way. This one, you know, defecated, so you see what happened. It just was liquefied and taken in by the wrinkles. Shunted, I took it away. Then I tried a phenylphthalein test, and of course it turns pink in the presence of hemoglobin, so it was a good test. And here's some bugs, how they are in a jar after feeding. And this was a picture sent from the UK of a person, an indigent, who had very long toenails, and the bugs were actually living then on the toenails. So that's another place where they stay, you know? This is a tarantula reaction, lice, fleas, flea bite dermatitis. Woman came in with bites and an excoriation from scratching, but part of that was because of the fleas that were biting her. Pigeon flies, you have pigeon nests, you have these flies feeding on pigeons, but also biting people. Different mites, ticks. This is the mouth part section of what goes in. This hypostome is what goes into the wound. This is Ixodes scapularis, the deer tick. These are some of the marks that people get from the EM, the Lyme disease reaction in the skin. Bird mites people find. These are rodent mites. Were misidentified as bed bugs because people are saying, well, it's three in a row, breakfast, lunch, dinner. But actually, the person brought me the mites, and these were actually rodent mite bites. These were mites that fell from trees on a person, very tiny pyomoted mite. They were actually parasitic on the beetles that were in the trees. They were biting people. These are book lice that are not so much biting people, but there's a possibility sometimes they do, and they cause dermatitis. Parasitoid ant-like wasps that people were treating as ants and not getting rid of them. In fact, these were stinging people because they're parasitic on the stored products that were infested in their house. And more wasps, the fly, a tiny bed bug. Bed bug relatives are misidentified as bed bugs. So if people didn't have bed bugs, they had these plant-feeding insects, or actually these are predaceous little tiny bugs feed on other insects. And that's, I think, what...